We're learning Parshat Emor. This week's Parsha here in Israel is in Emor. In the United States, they're still behind. They're doing Achrimos Kedoshim. They will catch up in 2 weeks. Parshat Emor. Hashem tells Moshe, Emor el Kohanim. Tell the Kohanim. Ve'amarta lehem. Tell the Kohanim. Wait, why'd you tell me to tell them twice? Tell the elders to warn the youngsters. So, in general, we say that our mitzvah vis-a-vis children breaks down into two. When a child is 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Your mitzvah of chinuch, we say it in Kriyat Shema. V'limatem otam et b'necheim. We teach them Torah, and we teach them, you know, when you'll be bar mitzvah, then you will have this mitzvah. You will have a mitzvah to shake lulav. When you'll be bar mitzvah, you'll have a mitzvah to hear shofar. When you'll be bar mitzvah, you'll have a mitzvah to light Hanukkah candles. So our first level of chinuch, and this is our biblical, our Doraita level of chinuch, is to tell children that when they reach adulthood, when they become bar mitzvah, 13 for a boy, 12 for a girl, they will be obligated in the mitzvot. Then the rabbis made a rabbinic obligation to train children to do mitzvot. So there's a rabbinic obligation when your child is old enough to shake a lulav and esrog, give him a lulav and esrog and let him do it. Wait, but the Torah doesn't obligate him, right? The rabbis obligate. You have to give your child a lulav and esrog so that he will do the mitzvah. A child is old enough that he knows how to wear tzitzit and keep his clothing clean. We buy him tzitzit and he practices, he's doing the mitzvah. He has a rabbinic obligation. He's old enough to daven, he davens. He's old enough to light Hanukkah candles, he lights Hanukkah candles for Ashkenazim. Sfardim right, the father lights for the whole household. So, with regards to most mitzvot, our mitzvah to give a child to perform the mitzvah is rabbinic. It's not biblical. That's why if you leave the house, you're traveling. Let's say you have to go teach a class in Antarctica. Chabad gave you a call. The Eskimos in Antarctica have a few Jews there. They want a class. And you're the man to go to Antarctica and give the class. So you won't be home for Shabbos. Okay, you're on an important mission. You have a 10-year-old son. And your wife says, let him make Kiddush for us. He can't do it because he's not obligated minat Torah. Biblically, he's not obligated. So he can't make Kiddush for your wife. Your wife is obligated in Kiddush. She has to make Kiddush for herself. The child can't make Kiddush for her because he's not yet obligated minat Torah biblically. So in general, the way we look at the Torah is we're all obligated from age 12 if you're a girl, 13 if you're a boy, and the underage, well, they're obligated rabbinically. The Torah doesn't obligate them. The rabbi said, we want you to practice, do this. However, there are exceptions. Before we get to the exceptions, I just want to summarize an idea that is an important idea. I tell it to children before their bar mitzvah. The Torah says, keep Shabbos. Ata, you, ubincha, and your son. So I ask the kids, I say, who's the ata and who's the bincha? Meaning, my father, he should live and be well, is he the ata and I'm the bincha? What about my kids? They're not included? They don't have a mitzvah of Shabbos? Or am I the ata and my son, who's 14, 15, he's the bincha? Well, how does that work? Who's the son that the Torah is talking about? Keep Shabbos, it says, Ata ubincha, you and your son. Who's the Ata? So the answer is, anyone who's 13 and up is Ata. Every mitzvah in Torah is speaking to a child once he reaches age 13. From that moment onward, he's the Ata. The Torah is talking to you. So a child has to understand that. I become 13, my identity is no longer the bincha, I'm no longer the son, I'm the father. You guys, Bezrat Hashem, will have this beautiful experience of coming to the hospital to pick up a child, and they give you the form to fill out, and it says on the form, father's name. And your first thought is to write your father's name. And then you have to remember, no, I'm the father. Father's name is me. You're the father. So long as the child is a minor, he's the bincha, he's the son. But once he becomes an adult, once he hits bar mitzvah age, so every mitzvah in the Torah is talking to him. Clear? So far we're clear?
Okay.
Now, there are mitzvot where the Torah says you're obligated for your kid as well. So that means even though we said the Torah doesn't obligate the children, the rabbis obligated the children, the Torah says train them that when they'll become adults, they'll do a mitzvah. But then there are mitzvot where the Torah says your child also has to keep the mitzvah. Give me one example you all know. We just said one example. Which example? Shabbos. Right? The Torah says, keep Shabbos you and your son. So the Torah is talking about a son who's a minor. So when it comes to Shabbos, we have an obligation that our kids should also keep Shabbos. Another example is eating kosher. We have a responsibility that our kids eat kosher. You can't give your child to play with non-kosher food. We got Doritos from Aza. Don't ask me how they got to our house. One of the kids went to some kind of party. They gave him out Doritos from Aza. So it had Aza. It had Arabic writing all over it. Nothing Jewish. So my kid said, Abba, is it kosher? So I said, I don't know. So they said, but Abba, it's Doritos. I said, right. It's Palestinian Doritos. You have no idea what the ingredients are. I don't either know. If I knew that Elite in the North manufactures the Doritos for Aza, and I know a guy in the factory, and he tells me, don't worry, it's the same ingredients, it's just a different label. Okay, so then I know. But if I don't know, so M&M's, you have manufactured in Egypt, and you have manufactured in Ireland, you have manufactured in different places, and the ingredients are different. So do I know what's in there? I told you guys that apricot flavor is made from worms, right? Apricot flavor, when you buy yogurt with apricot flavor, it's worm juice. They mashed worms. There's a specific worm that makes apricot flavor. There's a specific bug that makes strawberry flavor. It tastes better than the strawberry flavor. It tastes more strawberry than the strawberry flavor. So when you buy strawberry flavored yogurt and you tell yourself, what could be wrong with strawberry flavored yogurt? You're eating bug juice. If it has a heksher, then you're not. But if it's not, coming back to here, so we have a responsibility that our kids eat kosher. I told my kids, I'm very sorry if we don't know who made those Doritos. The fact that it all looks like the same Doritos, you have no idea if we don't know. So we can't eat it. My responsibility is that my kids eat kosher. So I was once walking by the Tachana Merkazit, and I saw M&M's that were brought in from Egypt and didn't have a heksher. So I wanted to contact the chief rabbinate to tell them, you know, people buy M&M's because much of the M&M's that's sold in Israel is imported from the United States. It has an OU. So if a person doesn't pay attention, they might buy M&M's thinking it's okay. And really, who knows what's in it? So I brought home, I went to the store and I bought those M&M's so I would have a sample to give the rabbanut. And then I come home, and maybe you guys imagine that in your home, your kids won't take sweets without permission. But in most homes, it's not as controlled as you think or would like it to be. So I wrapped it in 15 wrappings and hid it behind the bookcase, right? So they didn't know it existed. Why? Because I have to make sure my kids eat kosher. And if I brought home something that's non-kosher, it's my responsibility. They don't eat it. So we gave one example, Shabbos. Two example is kosher. Third example, if you're a Kohen, oh, very nice, if you're a Kohen, so our Parsha says, tell the Kohanim. Why do you say tell them twice? The old Kohanim have to take care of the young Kohanim. You have to make sure your kid, if you're a Kohen, so your kids, your boys, aren't allowed to become Tamei. So, no going into a cemetery. So a Kohen has to be careful not to come in contact with a dead body. A Kohen shouldn't volunteer in a hospital unless it's a hospital where people don't die. There are hospitals where a lot of the surgeries are elective and almost never people die there. You know, there you go to Asuta. Asuta is a hospital where most of what's done there is elective surgery, or it's they do hernias, they do all kinds of things which aren't dangerous. So you want, go volunteer there. But a Kohen is supposed to watch himself and his children, his male children, that they don't become tamei. So we have exceptions. Who are the exceptions? Father, mother, sister, brother, son, daughter, wife. Father, mother, sister, brother, son, daughter, wife. Now your sister, if she marries, then she becomes part of the other family. But those exceptions, a Kohen does become defiled for. He does take care of them. When they pass away, he has a responsibility to take care of their burial. And from there we learn that these are the relatives that a person mourns over. Who does a person sit shiva for? When they lose, God forbid, if they lose a sister, a brother, a son, a daughter, a wife, or a parent. So you have father, mother, sister, brother, son, daughter, wife. These are the what's called shiva krovim, the seven relatives, and they're the ones that a Kohen must become defiled for. There was once a Kohen who didn't want to become defiled. He said, someone else will take care of my sister. So the other Kohanim said, no, you have to. So he said, but it's Erev Pesach, I want to go bring the Paschal offering. They said, tough luck. And they forced him, and they defiled him, and he could not go bring the Paschal offering. So there's an obligation that Kohanim have to take care of these relatives. And part of what we learn here is the concept that we owe the deceased certain honors. When we mourn over the deceased, we show the value of life. You know, I always like saying, you're sitting and you're eating and suddenly a cockroach starts going towards your tea biscuits. So you take a phone book and you whack it over the head. And then goodbye cockroach, you continue eating lunch. Right? So
I'll probably run away somewhere.
So you'll run away.
Hard because they pretend they're dead. You have to keep hitting them hard.
But you will continue eating lunch. So Chazal say, when a human being dies, it's not a cockroach. You don't continue eating lunch. You stop your life. You show that the person had meaning, and by showing respect to the deceased, we show the value of life.
The Kohen must defile themselves.
Correct. It's a machlokas in the Gemara, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Akiva. That's how we rule.
What about if a young child loses the parents? The only child is 13 and loses their parents. What happens to him?
The halacha says, "Ein chinuch la'avelut." There's no.
Would you mourn for a married sister then?
Mourn, yes, but not get defiled. Torah says Kohanim have to be careful. They're not supposed to tear out their hair, cut off their hair in mourning, pull out their beard, scratch themselves to bleed. Kohanim have an extra warning not to do this. So here we have an interesting halachic discussion. A Kohen who defiles a mitzvah that's part of his sanctity. We once had a student who said to me, I'm a Kohen, but I love this girl who I'm not allowed to marry. She's a divorcee, but I love her, so I'm going to marry her. I'm willing to forgo, he said, my kahuna. That's not true. Every day he's married to her, he's transgressing. He's not allowed to marry her. So he said to me, but I love her. I said, okay, so wish her well. She should wish you well. You each have to build a separate life. You can't marry her. I'm sorry. Kohen's not allowed to marry a divorcee. So the Torah says that if a Kohen transgresses a mitzvah that's connected to his sanctity as a Kohen, then he loses his rights of kahuna. He cannot go up to the Torah as a Kohen. He cannot go up and do birkat kohanim, bless the Jewish people as a Kohen. He has defiled his sanctity as a Kohen. Now in our parsha, the Torah reiterated the commandment not to shave with a razor. Every Jew is prohibited from shaving with a razor. Why did the Torah reiterate it for Kohanim? So some say, because by a Kohen, it's not only the commandment every Jew has, it's also part of his holiness. So if a Kohen were to shave with a razor, according to that opinion, he would not be allowed to go up for a Kohen or to get do birkat kohanim. And there were times in Jewish history where, unfortunately, people were lax in this mitzvah. People shaved with razors. So those people, there's a machloket whether you're allowed to let them go up to do birkat kohanim. The Torah says, who is a kohen prohibited from marrying? So we know if a woman had an inappropriate relationship, which unfortunately, if a woman was with a non-Jew or someone else who she's prohibited to be intimate with, or if a woman is herself the descendant of kohanim who desecrated their holiness, meaning that's called a chalala. If her father married a divorcee, so she's a chalala. Kohen's not allowed to marry her. If she's herself is a divorcee, he's not allowed to marry her. One thing that people don't know is that if the woman has a non-Jewish father, even though her mother is Jewish, a kohen is not allowed to marry her. Even though technically her mother's Jewish, she's a Jew, but she's not allowed to marry a kohen. The Torah gives us a commandment, v'kidashto, treat him in sanctity. And that's why we let a kohen go up to the Torah first, and when we're having a meal and there's a kohen present, we honor them with benching. Sometimes people say, birshut kohen, they circumvent the kohen, they never ask him for permission, they just say, with the permission of the kohen, I'm going to lead benching. Excuse me, ask him for permission. Don't just say, birshut kohen. Ask him. I had many times in my house where there was a kohen, and I asked him, do you want to do benching or do you want to give permission to someone else? And he was like, I'll do benching. Okay. He didn't get the hint. I wanted to honor someone else. Okay. He got the hint and said, no, I'm not forgoing my rights. Okay. So he led benching. Yeah. So, unfortunately, many times when a woman is a balat tshuva, so before she was chozer b'tshuva, she had relations with people, sometimes a non-Jew, or sometimes she doesn't even know. Well, she doesn't remember who everyone was. And unfortunately, that's why we assume that a chozer b'tshuva cannot marry a kohen, yeah. It's unfortunate the world we live in, but yeah. I would just add that being that the world is so promiscuous, we also assume that if a girl converted after she was 3 years old, so we say who knows what her history holds. And so also she would not be allowed to marry a kohen. That's the idea. It's not a problem we have with the giyoret, it's a problem we have with the adult environment in which she grew up. We have no way of knowing what she underwent. So we, yeah. Correct. He's still a kohen. What can I do? There are instances where the kohen himself has been defiled. His father married a divorcee, etc. So then he's a halal. Then he can marry like everyone else. But the poor guy is a halal. Yeah.
Yeah, what happens if the person kind of doesn't really want to bench because he doesn't really know that well?
Again? He won?
If the kohen is embarrassed to bench because he doesn't really know how to do it properly or whatever else, do you still call upon him?
He's allowed to say, I give up the honors. He should say, I'm give the honors to someone else.
It's embarrassing for him to do that.
So you can quietly ask him, not in front of everyone else. Now we have the Kohen Gadol. Kohen Gadol is close to Hashem. He's supposed to be in constant happiness. And so we consider Kohen Gadol as though he's always in a festive occasion. Just like when we have a Yom Tov, we have a Regel. It's Pesach, it's Shavuos, it's Sukkos. So people don't sit mourning. So too the Kohen Gadol is not supposed to ever be in mourning. And so even if his parent passed away or a close relative, he does not defile himself. He retains his holiness. Yes. So how would a Kohen Gadol attend his own parents' funeral? So they would take the funeral procession down the street, and then when they turn the corner, he'd come to that street. He'd always have to be a street behind. So that he rounds the corner, he goes on to that street as he sees them rounding the next corner. He always stays one block behind. He stays around the corner away from the procession. So he shows them the honor, he goes, but he doesn't defile his holiness. He stays that far back from the funeral procession. Yes?
Yeah, what happened if, based on what you said yesterday about...
Should I go on or should I wait?
Yeah, no, just go on.
So that's a Kohen Gadol.
Huh?
That example said that was a Kohen Gadol.
Yeah? Correct, that's a Kohen Gadol.
Oh, yeah. What happens if they defile their holiness by marrying someone who they shouldn't? But then, based on what you said yesterday about somebody says, I found out that I should live on a hill in Hebron or something like that. So then they suddenly want to change, they want to regain their holiness by divorcing this person with their three kids and whatever else, and going to mikvah, and voila, and presto, they're holy again. Is that possible? Can they change it back? Or
yeah.
Gone, it's gone.
Yeah. Sort of like, the kids are chalalim. The kids don't get undone. They have an avera, but... they themselves don't get defiled. So if they divorce the woman, then they go back to their kashrut. But the children who were born from that marriage are halalim. That cannot be undone.
And are they unholy in a sense?
I don't know the word unholy. They have they've been blemished in their genealogy.
So is that their fault?
It's not their fault. Just like a person whose mother took crack when she was pregnant, it's not his fault. But she did harm him. We can... In this world, a person can harm other people. So it's not the person who gets harmed, it's not their fault. The person, I had a friend whose eyes were out to hear, his ears were little ears, and I never asked him, but I always assumed his mother drank a lot of alcohol when she was pregnant with him, and that's how they describe people whose mother drinks alcohol when they're pregnant, that the child comes out with eyes smaller and more far out, ears that are smaller, etc. There are all kinds of classical birth defects. So I always assumed that this friend of mine, that's why he looked that way. Is it his fault? What did he do? Okay, so just like in the physical world, people can do irresponsible acts that harm a fetus. The Torah reveals to us that in the spiritual sense, people can also do it. And that's what King Solomon weeps about in Ecclesiastes and Kohelet. He says, "Dimat ashukim," the tear of those who were harmed, illegitimately, and who could comfort them? It's not fair. It's
can
not
you
fair.
These children, who their dad just divorced them.
What can you? Just what can you comfort them? Their father did something bad, and they're biting the bullet, right?
So can you fix that in a sense? You make the shuva up or something like that, or if it's there.
There's nothing you can do. There's nothing you can do. Just like the woman who took crack when she was pregnant. What can you do?
What is the next generation after that? They marry.
It's over. Nothing you can do.
All the following through, every generation.
Yeah. And they still, like, they do good stuff in this world. And, you know,
they'll get merits. It's not held against them in that sense. They can be big tzaddikim, but halalim, they're halalim.
Really? They can become, like, you know, Rav Cook or something?
Why not? That's their responsibility, to be big tzaddikim, sure. I didn't hear you. No, the daughter of a Kohen is allowed to marry any kosher Jew. She's allowed to marry a divorced man. She's allowed to, yeah. The daughter of a Kohen doesn't have these restrictions. Any Israelite, yeah. The sons have these restrictions. The what male Kohanim.
What happens if it's a woman, a Kohen, marries a non... I mean, a woman, female Kohen marries a male Kohen. A male non-Kohen. Are the kids not Kohen?
Nope. It only goes through the father. Now, the Torah lists all kinds of blemishes that disqualify a Kohen from serving in the Beit HaMikdash. He could be a fantastic Jew. However... In the Beit HaMikdash, when you're representing Hashem in the temple, so there's a certain atmosphere that should be there. If you come to the Beit HaMikdash and you see that all the different handicapped people are the ones who are employed in the Beit HaMikdash, then you start feeling like, oh, you couldn't get any other job, so you're serving in the Beit HaMikdash. However, if you come to the Beit HaMikdash and you see healthy, honorable people serving there, then you walk away with the feeling, wow, it's an honor to serve Hashem. So it's not that there's anything wrong with a person, but at the end of the day, we are concerned with the image that the people who visit the Beit HaMikdash receive. It's not their fault. There's nothing wrong with them. They could be big tzaddikim. But when it comes to this job, that's not their job in life. To be representative of the Beit HaMikdash, that's not their job. And so the Torah lists all kinds of blemishes that a kohen can have that would disqualify them from that representation in the Beit HaMikdash. Remember, people visited the Beit HaMikdash. It was meant to inspire them for the rest of the year. You showed up sometimes once a year, sometimes three times a year. But if you went for Sukkot, you had 6 months where you had no shul, you had very little connection, you had no organized prayer, and that inspiration that you got on Sukkot was supposed to hold you for the next 6 months, as every day you'd say your sentence or two of prayer before you went out to work. It was supposed to be an experience going up to the Beit HaMikdash, an awe-inspiring experience. We're moving forward in the parasha. The Torah tells us how the Kohanim had to be careful that if they touched something or they themselves became defiled, so they have to take care of the laws of purity before they re-enter the Beit HaMikdash. The Torah tells us that the Kohanim have rights to eat truma. We know here in Israel, when we buy or when we grow food, so we take off 1/50, we give to the Kohen, that's truma. Torah says the Kohanim have to be careful with that truma. They can't eat it unless they are pure. That's why today they don't eat truma. Challah, when we make a new piece of dough, which is a large enough volume, about 2 kilo. So then we take off a part of that dough and we give to the kohen. That's also a form of truma. What we call challah today is a misnomer. Challah really is the portion of dough you take off to give to the kohen. Torah says you have to be careful that a person who's a non-kohen is prohibited from eating the truma of the kohen. The kohen's family is allowed to. What happens if his daughter marries a Levite or an Israelite? So now she's married to him. She no longer is allowed to eat truma. If she becomes a widow, she gets divorced, she comes back home, she again is considered his daughter and may eat from his truma again. What happens if you ate truma by mistake? So the Torah says pay back with a tax. Give the kohen the truma and give him a fifth. What's a fifth? So let's say you ate the volume of, let's say, 100 grams of truma, you have to give back 125 grams of truma. Wait, that's not 1/5. 1/5 is 20%. On 100 grams, it should be 120. How'd you get to 125? So we assume that when the Torah says fifth, what the Torah means is take your prime number, divide it into four, and add a fifth component that equals the first four. So the term fifth in Torah is what we call in modern mathematics a quarter. A fifth means divide the principal by four and add a fifth component equal to the first four. So when I want to know what a fifth of 100 is, the answer is divide 100 by four and you get 25, right? And you add a fifth component, another 25, which equals to the first four components. So that's how we do math in Torah. In Torah, when we have a fraction, so that's the discussion in Talmud. Is it milibar or milegav? We rule it's milibar, that it's from without. The fifth is outside. It's the outside of the first four. You divide your principal by four and you add a fifth component. Okay, we're up to shlishi. Yes?
Going back on what you said about the Kohanim being hurt or whatnot, they cannot serve if they're crippled. What if they have a biomechanical arm or leg?
Oh, no can do.
No can do?
Okay. Nope. Torah tells us when we bring a sacrifice, make sure to bring a whole animal. Same concept. Don't take your, your rejects and offer them to the temple. Take your best and bring it to the temple. So if you have an animal that went blind, don't say, oh, that's a great animal to bring as a sacrifice. Next time I go up, I'll bring that as a sacrifice, right? Think about it. How many times do we do that? How many times do we give to charity or to as gifts those things which we don't want? You know, when you get married, so you get all kinds of wedding gifts. And then there are those wedding gifts which you realize, this is going to be a great gift to give the next guy, because I have no use for it. Right? So that's what people do. They leave a pile of those useless gifts. That's what I'll give the next guy. Why do you think you got those set of linen? Because the previous guy thought they were disgusting. Okay.
What if you're just trying to make a good joke out of it?
Okay, so the Torah tells us that we when we bring to the Beit HaMikdash, we take our chosen animal. And that's what it says in the Navi, that Hakriveu na lefechatecha. If you were to take that and bring it as a gift to your governor, Hayirtzecha, do you think he'd like you over that? Or Hayisafanecha, you think he'd treat you better because you brought him that kind of gift? So you have to ask yourself, people sometimes bring to shul their worn out talis. You want to donate a talis to the shul, go buy a nice new talis and donate it to the shul. So people say, no, it's still usable, this is good for the shul. No, it's not. Donate the good stuff to the shul. So this is a concept the Torah is teaching us. Don't bring the Beit HaMikdash, your blemished animals. And the Torah goes into all kinds of blemishes. The Torah says, "Uve'artzechem lo tasu." The Torah describes animals that had their gonads crushed. Different situations where an animal is infertile because its gonads were crushed either by human hand or by instrument. And then the Torah says, and don't do that in your land. So the Torah is saying, we may not neuter an animal. Torah says you're not allowed to castrate to cause an animal to be infertile. That's a mitzvah in our parsha. Torah says don't offer an infertile animal as a sacrifice, and don't do that. Don't do that to any animal that's by you, meaning you're not supposed to castrate or neuter your animals. So you'll ask, am I allowed to ask a non-Jew to do it? Are there ways to do it that are permissible? So you'll ask your local Orthodox rabbi if that ever comes up by you. We move on, and the Torah tells us that an animal must be given 7 days with its mother before it can be offered as a sacrifice. This is only true for sacrifices. Animals that you eat, you're allowed to slaughter the first day they're born. You have a mitzvah not to slaughter the parent and the child on the same day. The mother and her child should not be slaughtered on the same day. That's true with regards to our own meat as well, not only in the Beit HaMikdash. But in the Beit HaMikdash, there's a special concept. The animal must experience a Shabbos. And from here we have the concept that before a person brings his child to be circumcised, the child also experiences a Shabbos. And so the Ashkenazim have a custom that the first Shabbos that a child experiences, we celebrate the first Friday night with the child, and that's what's called Shalom Zachar, that corresponds to this mitzvah. The Torah tells us, watch the mitzvos and perform them. Watch the mitzvos, what's the Torah telling us? Our tradition is the Torah is telling us, learn Mishnah. Watch the mitzvos means, don't just observe the Torah the way you think it makes sense. Watch the mitzvos, watch over the oral commandment that Hashem gave you, what we call Mishnah, which then evolves into Talmud, etc. We're up to Ravi. And Ravi begins a section of the Parsha which commands us the Shabbos and all the holidays. We read this on most holidays. On Sukkot, on Pesach, we read this section of the Torah. Here in Parshat Emor, the Torah says, let me tell you what are the days that you should designate as holidays. Now when the Torah calls it a holiday, the Torah calls it Mikra Kodesh. What does the word Mikra mean? Mikra could mean to designate it as such. So that's what we do with Kiddush. We designate the day as a day of holiness. That's the concept of Kiddush. I'm saying this is the start of this holy day. Mikra Kodesh also means a gathering of holiness. And from here, Nachmanides says there's a special mitzvah to daven with a minyan on Yom Tov. A person should daven with the community. It's Mikra Kodesh, a time of gathering. Families should get together on a holiday. Communities should get together on a holiday. It's Mikra Kodesh. It's a designated time to unite. What's the first holiday that's mentioned? Shabbos. So it's telling us, don't think that the holidays are less than Shabbos. You have to adhere to the holidays just like you keep Shabbos. Take them seriously. What's the first holiday we speak about? Pesach. Okay. I recommend you take this week. You have now 4 more days till Shabbos. Take a Jewish calendar and try to make sure you know the 12 months by heart and which holidays and which month. Okay? So now I'm going to ask you a few trick questions. Okay? Which holiday is in the month of Teves? Trick question. Which holiday is in Tishrei? We'll start from the beginning. So Tishrei, we have Rosh Hashanah is the first of Tishrei. Yom Kippur is the 10th of Tishrei. And Sukkot is the 15th of Tishrei. And Shmini Atzeres is 8 days later. Okay? Okay, Hoshana Rabbah is the last day of Chol Hamoed. Fine. Cheshvan, are there any holidays in Cheshvan? No, it's called Mar Cheshvan. We tell the kids it's like the bitter month. It's got no holidays. Kislev, what's in the month of Kislev? Chanukah, and Chanukah extends into the month of Teves. Shvat, what do we have in Shvat? Tu B'Shvat. So it's not really a holiday, it's the beginning of the year for the trees. Adar, what do we have in the month of Adar? Purim, okay, Purim. No questions now. Now we've reached Nisan. Which holiday is in the month of Nisan? Pesach is on which day of the month of Nisan? The 14th is the Paschal offering, and the 15th is the holiday, right? So Yom Tov of Pesach is on the 15th. What's an Iyar? Yeah, Pesach Sheni, okay. The 15th of Iyar is Pesach Sheni. You have Lag BaOmer, I guess. And Shavuot shows up in Sivan, on the 6th of the month of Sivan. What do we do on Tammuz? What happens on the 17th of Tammuz? We have the fast. And 3 weeks later, on the 9th of Av, we have Tisha B'Av. And then we move into the month of Elul, that also has really no holidays. In the month of Elul, we have the Slichot. You Sfardi? Oh, so the Sfardim start their Slichot from the beginning of Elul. Our preparation for Tishrei Rosh Hashanah. I recommend you start doing a number of things. Number one, try to memorize the 12 months by heart. Number two, try to make sure you know which holidays and which month. Number three, you're in Israel. Take advantage. On all your papers, you should write the Hebrew date. What day is it today, guys? What month are we in now? Let's start with that.
ER.
We're in ER. What day of the month of ER?
9th. 8th to 9th.
If you get used to putting the date, the Jewish date, you know that in Israel, the law is that you're allowed to use the Jewish date on your checkbook. You write a check, write the Jewish date. Get used to using the Jewish date. Do you know your birth date on the Hebrew calendar? Check it out. Make sure you know it. So we should try to live by the Jewish calendar because that's really the first mitzvah Hashem gave the Jewish people. So in this week's parsha we have the mitzvot of the holidays. I recommend trying to zoom in so that you know, for example, when do we go around the bima 7 times? When do we go around the bima in shul in Sukkot, and on the last day of Shana Rabbah we go 7 times? When do we beat the arava on the ground 5 times? Also on Hashanah Rabbah. When do we stay up all night long learning Torah? Shavuot. Okay. When is Simchas Torah? At the end of Sukkot is Simchat Torah. Okay. When do we fast over Gedalia ben Achikam being assassinated? Gedalia, Tzom Gedalia is the morning after Rosh Hashanah, the 3rd of Tishrei. So you guys know it. Let's make sure we know it a little bit better so that we live the months. And it's a good idea to get into the habit of writing the Jewish month on your papers so you start living the months. Tov.